Hi, this is the Tempter Podcast, Innovation at the Edge with Open Source. So today we have Michael Lynch back with us again. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
And how are you doing, Cam?
I'm doing very well, thank you.
Good, good. So Michael is on the verge of releasing his new book, Refactoring English. We had Michael on the podcast in May of 2025, where we talked about the beginning of his book project and writing in general. Today, we hope to get more insights into what Michael has learned in the past year, how the writing process has gone, and maybe some insights into self-publishing and et cetera. So, Michael, some of our listeners have probably not listened to the previous episode. Could you give us a brief overview of your career and what you do?
Sure. Yeah. So I started working as a developer about 20 years ago. My first job was as a developer at Microsoft. I worked there for a few years, and then I worked for a few years at Google. And in 2018, I left Google to just work for myself. I didn't really have a good idea of what business I wanted to start. I figured like I would probably fail a lot and try a few things, and that's exactly what happened. And my first real successful business was in 2020. I created a company called Tiny Pilot that made a hardware product. And I ran that product, ran the company until 2024, and then I sold it just before my first child was born. And then once I became a father, I wanted something. With running a hardware product, there's like a lot of balls to juggle. There's like a lot of things that can go wrong, and I wanted to shift to something that was like much more predictable and not something where like I was going to get paged or have to like fix a supply chain issue at 3 a.m. on a Sunday. And so I've been wanting to write this book. I actually started talking about this book in I think 2020 or 2021, and I figured it was a good time to write the book. And I thought it was going to take me like 6 months, and I'm on month 19, I think, or maybe month 20.
Wow.
Yeah, that sounds typical. So I would encourage anyone who's interested to go look at Michael's blog. He details his adventures in a very, very thorough way. So you can read all about his Tiny Pilot business and how that went, how he sold it. Yep. All the details are there. So it's a great learning resource. So you're near release of this book. And can you give us an overview on the status and where you're at?
Sure. So I wrote the book in pieces and mostly out of order. And so it feels like everything's done, but it also feels like I can't release a book that I haven't read myself. So I want to do at least one full read through. And I'm about halfway through the first read through, and it's mostly like what I expected. So there's not like a lot of big changes that I'm encountering, because like people have been reading it all along and giving me feedback, and I've been doing edits. But I want to do like a full start to finish pass. And so halfway through that pass, and once I'm finished with that, I'm gonna call it 1.0. Because it's an ebook, it's like very easy to make little changes after the 1.0 release. Mm-hmm. So I'll probably still keep tweaking it based on feedback. But I'm expecting to have it in like the official release sometime in mid-August. I've been calling it early access for the past year and a half.
Yeah. Yeah, I've been part of this early access program, and it's been fun to read the chapters as you release them and watch the evolution of the book. So it's neat you're treating it's like software. So it's like a 1.0 release, and then you'll probably make little tweaks as time goes on.
Exactly.
Improve it. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Cause last time I tried something like this, I made a video course, and I really like making the video course, but it's so much harder to edit a video course. Like you can't be like, oh, okay, like I want to adjust what I said in that video. Like you'd have to reshoot basically the whole video. Whereas ebooks are much more friendly to like little edits and little improvements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So you could have written a general writing book, right? What does writing for developers specifically need its own book? So what's actually different about the audience you're targeting?
The honest answer is not much. Like I think for a lot of developers, if they see a book that's a general writing book, they're like, well, that's not for me. Mm-hmm. And so I think there's not much work in like bridging the gap of like, okay, like let's make all the examples based on developers. That said, like, so I think actually somebody who is not a developer could read the book and like take away most of the same things, but it is, you know, I'm a developer, so it's like from my perspective as a developer, and like the reason I wanted to write a book, like I don't think I'm the world's best writer. Like I don't think if I wrote like a book for novelists, they would be like, oh, okay, like that guy has a lot to teach me. But like as a developer, and it's like somebody who's learned to write as part of like their career and part of their indie business, like I've learned a lot, and it's one of those things where like it feels like once you learn it, like, oh, everybody knows this. And then I would talk to other developers and find out like, oh, wait, right. There's like so many things that I like had to learn through trial and error that like not everybody else knows. And so I think like positioning it and like focusing on the niche of developers, even though like the writing techniques, you know, like good writing for a developer is the same as good writing for an architect or a lawyer or something, you know, 90% is probably gonna be the same techniques. But I think for developers, seeing something that's specifically speaking to them and like with everything about their job, like thinking about like, how do you write commit messages? How do you write design documents? It makes it a lot easier to apply to their life and the kind of problems they solve.
Yeah. So in other words, like, you know, anybody can read this book. There are like general principles that they can
apply. Yeah.
So maybe just give us a quick overview of the book. What's in it? How's it? I know it's split up into several sections.
But. Yeah. So I did have a lot of trouble figuring out like exactly how to structure it. The thing that I originally wanted to, the way I originally wanted to structure it, is I changed it for a while and then it sort of ended up back at the same place. But the first half is general writing techniques and principles. So things that are not specific to any kind of writing. And then the second half is more like applied techniques. So, talking about how you use all the things that we talked about in the first half and like how you apply them to, okay, you're writing an email, you're writing an email to your teammates, or you're writing a commit message description or like a pull request description. You're writing a design doc, things like that. So like the more like applications of these writing principles to make it more concrete. Mm-hmm. But the reason that it was, I originally like had that in mind, and then I surveyed readers and I was like, what are the chapters that you're interested in? And people were really not interested in like verbs and passive voice. So they're like, well, I don't care about that. Like, I don't need passive voice for my job, but like, I do need to understand how to write design documents, or like, I do want to know how to write a blog post that's going to attract a lot of people to my product. And so I was like, okay, I guess I should put the ones that people are interested in first. And then what I ultimately did was, well, but then I was just getting a lot of feedback from readers that were just like, I don't understand. Like, it's like goes from passive voice to blog posts to like, and I was like, it doesn't make sense. Like, I can't just do it based on like how much people are interested. I think it has to be kind of like, what I ultimately decided was like, I wanted it to be, like optimized for return on investment. So like I wanted it to be like you read the least amount and get the most value out of it. So like the second chapter is just one page. It's about like reading your writing aloud, because I think that's a really valuable technique and it's really easy to apply. Mm-hmm. And so the ultimate structure was like, okay, like what's, if you like have to give up on this book a third of the way through, like what's the most value you're going to get? But I want it to be like the most valuable things first, so that you keep reading and finding new things that are helpful. Mm-hmm.
So you've been at this for over a year now. What have you learned about writing in the process of writing about writing?
Yeah.
It's a little meta, but you know.
Yeah. I think the biggest thing I found is to like embrace the things that make you a unique writer. Like I had this chapter at one point. So one of the things that has been most successful for me in writing is like when I have a new product, a thing that a lot of people struggle with is like they have a new product or they have a like an open source project and they want people to pay attention to it and try it out. But they're like, how do I get people to care? Like there's a million products out there. And so the way I've always solved that is like I figure out something about my product that's interesting to write about. And I publish a blog post and I'll submit it to like the programming subreddit or Hacker News or Lobsters. And then a lot of people read the blog post and then they're like, oh, okay. And like, you're also talking about this product you worked on. Like, I'll check out the product. And so I wanted to write about that. Like, I think that's a thing that's really valuable to people. And the like the common term for that is content marketing. And that like, it's a term I never really liked because it feels like you're just writing for the sake of marketing. Like it feels like a trick or something. Like, oh, this is like, I trick you into reading my content and then like, that's how I get you to buy from me. And like, I always thought of it as like, I want to write something that like my target customer is interested in. And then like they organically become interested in my product as a result. And so I wrote a chapter called like, it was something like, you know, how to do content marketing through blogging. And I got a lot of feedback from readers that were like, yeah, I don't like this chapter. And I was like, well, why? Like, why don't you like the content? Like, I think that's like, to me, like one of the most valuable chapters in the book is like, mm-hmm. like being able to teach people to like attract customers for free. And like, it scales really well. And they're like, I don't know, like marketing is just like, it just feels really like gross. And I was like, oh, you feel the way I feel. And like, I was like trying to adjust the language, like anticipating that my readers are going to be like, oh, we really like content marketing. Mm-hmm. And so I changed it to like how to find customers through blogging. And people are like, oh yeah, like I want to do that. Mm. And I realized just like, yeah, the people that are buying this book, like it's not going to be like a bestseller in the New York Times. Like people aren't going to be like, oh, I like just see a billboard on the street and be like, oh, I got to buy that book. Like most of the people that buy this book, like are buying it because they have some exposure to me. Like they've read one of my blog posts, or they like, maybe they've followed my career or the retrospectives that I write. And so they're like, I like this guy. Like I want to support Michael, or like, I want to learn something from him specifically. And so like, that's one of the biggest things I learned is just like, they want to learn from me specifically. So like, I should write in the way that I think about these things, not in the way that I think people like expect to learn about these things. So like, if I don't say content marketing personally, like I shouldn't describe things in terms of content marketing in the book. Like I should just describe it in the way I think about it, which is like just finding customers through blogging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. That's just be authentic. And that's really what works the best, especially in this age with all the AI noise and such. So
right. Yeah. And like, especially with AI, and like, I get a lot of questions of like, well, why would I improve writing like when there's AI? And, you know, like, I don't know what's going to happen. Like, maybe it is, maybe everything, like AI takes over everything and nobody writes. But I'm like, for at least the time being, like, you can't stand out in a world where everybody is writing with AI. Like, if you're using AI to do writing, like, you're just never going to stand out because everybody can do the same thing. And like, generally, there's no reason for somebody to go to you to use like AI to generate a blog post, because they could just get the same information from AI. Like they can cut out the middleman and just ask AI themselves. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I almost think AI is getting worse at writing as it gets smarter and smarter. So I don't know what's going on there, but you know, it just seems like it's.
Yeah.
There is also like, I see AI kind of like, does it make you learn, right? So I think. Honing your skills to become a better writer, or you are producing it at a, like, you know, reaching toward that mediocrity and then stay there forever.
Right. Yeah. That's what I think is really difficult. Like, I feel like for me, like, I feel like my writing is better than AI. So like, I don't really have a temptation to use AI, but like, let's say AI, you know, like let's say 100% is like the best writing possible. And like, let's say I feel like I'm writing at like an 80%. And like AI can write at maybe like 60% or something. And so if you're somebody who's like, I feel like my writing is like 20% or 30%, you're like, of course I want to just like immediately jump up to 60%. But then I think it like, it's hard. You get stuck at that local maxima. And so one thing I've been struggling with in like working with writers who feel like they're like way below AI is like to like, how do I get them off the training wheels of AI? Like, how do I get them to, like, if you're just relying on AI, then yeah, like, where is the growth? Like, where is the time where like you're going to grow? And like the way I think is best to do that is like to use AI to get feedback, but not to use AI to like, my general rule is like AI should not touch your documents. Like it should not write into your documents. Like you can show your document to an AI and like get suggestions, but like AI should not be writing for you. Like it should act as a teacher. I mean, I know of course it can, but I think like I expect it to like kind of stunt your growth if AI is just writing for you. But it's hard. This is changing really fast.
Yeah, I think this is very interesting if I look at what you just said, because you know, in this case, it's providing you a review and maybe as a consultant, you know, and you are free to accept it or not, but you know, at least you maintain your voice, your narrative. So I think that's
The instant you let, you know, it's tempting to just let AI make this little tweak to your document. Yeah, that looks like a good change. And it's asking you, should I make it? And you're saying, oh, yeah, go ahead. But the instant you give into that, it just like takes over. And it's all of a sudden it's in there. And if you're going to go that path, you really have to resist that temptation.
Yeah.
And strongly hold that line, or else it's hard to maintain that.
One way AI has like kind of tricked me into letting it write is like I never let AI like write for me, but I'll if I want to like include a graph or something in a blog post, I'm like, okay, here's a CSV, like can you know write some JavaScript to turn it into a graph the way I want? And then sometimes I'll like come back to the document and be like, wait, I didn't write. And then like it writes like little intros that I didn't ask it to write. It's like, here's a graph show. I'm like, I wrote this? This sounds terrible. Like, no, AI slipped that in. So you have to like really stay on top of it.
Yeah. I should correct what I said earlier. I do let AI make proofing corrections.
Yeah.
But that's a very specific instruction to it. So.
Yeah. Yeah. For grammar, I'll let it, and then I'll like review that commit exactly to make sure like I'm seeing everything it did. It didn't go rogue and decide to rewrite everything.
Yeah. So, you know, is there any like, you know, your like code has anti-patterns, right? So sticking to our theme of, you know, developers, is there any anti-pattern for prose writing that you learned all the way along, you know?
Oh yeah, tons. So I think the biggest for developers is meandering. I think developers really love getting into like the minutiae of things and getting into like implementation details. And I think sometimes developers forget that like not everybody has the same context they have. And so like they want to explain something, but they're like, okay, so here's like this technique you can apply to Python. But first, let me explain how the like Python just-in-time compiler works. But like actually you didn't really need to know that. The person was just like excited about this detail. And like maybe it helps you 1% to read this like 3-paragraph introduction about the Python just-in-time compiler. But like by that point, most readers have given up because they're like, why am I reading this? Like, I don't care about the just-in-time compiler. I was interested when they said they had a technique for me, but like, I don't care about the just-in-time compiler. And so I think that's a thing that a lot of developers, that's like the number one mistake I see developers making is like the people who are reading your writing, like they have, you know, unless it's like your teammate who has to read your email for some reason, but even then, like they have 1,000 other emails that are probably sitting in their inbox. And if they're reading just like on Reddit or Twitter, there's a billion other articles they could be reading. And so if your article doesn't explain to them like who it's relevant to and why it's valuable for them to read it, they're going to give up. And so, and I think it's one of the common mistakes, and it's also really hard to do well. It's really hard to like pack it into like, you know, 2 to 3 sentences. Like, why should you stick with me? Like, why should you continue reading this blog post, this email, this design document? But yeah, that's definitely the biggest anti-pattern I see.
Yeah, very interesting. I think we, you know, putting the developer hat on, we try to be very elaborate.
Yeah.
Lots of detail. Yeah, that's one thing I really appreciate about your book is you emphasize going from the most important information first to the You know, if somebody's only going to read part of this email or part of this document, what's the most important thing they need to know? Put that at the front. And maybe that's one way technical writing is a little different than most other writing is you're really trying to convey information. So you want to make that as effective as possible.
Yeah. And it's like you see a similar thing in journalism. Like journalists know this really, really well. It's called the inverted pyramid, where the headline is the thing that is going to grab the most people's attention. And then you assume that, you know, after the first paragraph or two, most people are going to drop off. And then by the end, like 90% of the readers have like moved on because they don't care about every last detail. Mm-hmm. And so journalists will try to structure their articles where it's like, what's the most important thing about this? So if it's like, you know, there was a kitten that was discovered that can talk, like that's the headline. And then, you know, the kitten's like lineage is going to be like paragraph 9. You want the things that are like the things everybody's interested in and right at the top.
Yeah.
So it took like almost 18 months in right now, right? So to write all this, and I'm sure you went through, you know, the quote unquote writer's block. And, you know, and maybe at times things are coming easy and flowing.
Yeah.
So when you get stuck writing, right, a book about writing.
Yeah.
Did your own advice work on you or did you do some tweaks?
Yeah. I mean, I actually found it helpful. Like I write about writer's block in the book and like writing about writer's block did help me to deal with writer's block. Mm-hmm. I find that with a lot of things that I write about. So like I have ideas in my mind that are kind of organized, like disorganized, like these are my techniques. But if I force myself to like sit down and write them out, like I experienced this when I wrote about code reviews. I'm like, you know, I think I have like a bunch of principles that I follow when I do code reviews. And then when I like sat down and wrote them out, ever since I read the article, I'm like, oh wait, I'm not following my rule. Like I like wrote this out, I published it. And so it's kind of the same thing with dealing with writer's block, like the things that I talk about to like maintain motivation. And like one of them is just forcing yourself to sit down for like a defined time block. So say like, for me, it's an hour, but like it can be different for different people, depending on like how much you can tolerate just sitting in front of the computer and like focusing on your writing. But that's an hour of like not checking social media, not checking email, not like doing other work, but just like focusing on writing. And like, as I'm writing this chapter on motivation, I'm like, well, I keep checking social media, I keep checking email. And like, I know that's the wrong thing to do. And like, I'm writing that down. And like, once I write it down, I'm like, okay, well, like, obviously, like, I know what's causing me to lose focus is that like, I'm not following these techniques that I know are good. And it also like happens upstream of that. Like, I think it's like, if you are checking social media every 5 minutes, like that usually isn't the problem in itself. It's like something else is like causing you to have less focus. Like maybe you're writing at the end of the day when you don't have as much willpower, or maybe like you're writing when you're really hungry and like something is really distracting you. And so just like being forced to think about like, okay, what are the things that I do to like try to get back on track? I found helpful for like explaining how to stay focused and how to maintain motivation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's when you write about it, you realize, you know, it's a lot. Whatever you write about, whether it's writing about development or how to do this or that, pretty soon you find yourself like, wait a minute, am I doing this?
So, right.
So it's a good way to learn to improve your own self-discipline.
Yeah, definitely.
And I just read a book recently about walking and they've done a lot of studies, and people that get up every hour or half hour and take a walk have much better focus than people who don't.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So there's a lot of ways to improve our focus, but that's a very interesting topic.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think for me, it's more like, you know, when you sit down writing, you also understand how much you understand about the topic you're writing.
Right.
And it's very difficult at times when you get to a point where, you know, you want to escape and you just grab onto something that's like,
So
I think what you said about social media or other aspects of it, right?
Yeah. One thing that took me a long time to figure out too is like you can do things that seem like you're still writing, but it is a big interruption to your focus. So like a thing that I would do all the time would be like, okay, like I'm writing, I'm like in a good flow. And then I'm like, oh, you know, there was this blog post that I want to like link to that I think would be really good. And so I'm like, just search for the blog post. But then like in searching for it, I like find something else and then I kind of get lost. Or like what's even more dangerous is like, oh, there was like a tweet about this. And so you like open up Twitter and then you're like, what was I doing? And then like an hour later, you're like, I've just been. And so one of the things I learned to do was to just split your writing into different phases. So like if you have a phase where like all you're doing is writing and not looking things up, and then you have it like a separate dedicated phase for like, okay, I made a to-do list of all the things that I need to look up. I'm just going to do those, like knock those out one after the other. You're not risking like knocking yourself out of this flow state where like you have focus and then you squandered it by like checking Twitter or doing something that is like ostensibly part of your writing, but is like essentially like a different phase.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great advice, basically to not take interruptions, just write them down and then do them later.
Yeah.
It's similar to like batching your email, just checking once an hour or something like that. Those things work if you can do them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you did something very interesting. You released your book from the start and people could pre-order it and then get updates as you went.
Yep.
How did that process go? Would you do it again? And what was the value?
Yeah, it worked really well for me. I kind of don't understand how people, like I think people that write, I've talked to other software developers that write books and like the timeline seems pretty similar to my timeline. Mm-hmm. But I don't know how you do it just like in a vacuum and then just come out and say like, oh, okay, here's my finished book. Or like maybe you just have like one editor giving you notes. I find that so difficult. Like I think the hardest parts of the book were just like really long chapters where it was like, okay, like, you know, I've got 6 weeks or 8 weeks to finish this. It's gonna take me like 8 weeks before I have something I can share with readers. And even then I would do stuff where if like I was working on a long chapter, I would invite readers and say like, hey, like I don't have the chapter ready, but like I just want to kind of talk through as like a presentation the ideas I want to talk about in this chapter, and like I want to hear what questions people have. And Cliff, you were super helpful. Like I think you came to all of those, and you and other people who were reading the book had great feedback and helped me understand, like really helped like crystallize my thoughts and get me focused on what people are interested in. And so for me, it worked out really well. Like I got super lucky. Like I did it through Kickstarter. I think I set the goal as $5,000, $6,000. I don't even remember what I set the goal as. But up to day, it was like a month to get to $6,000. And I think on day 27 out of 30, I think I was at like 60% of my goal. And I was like, there's just no way. Like I've already like exhausted all the options I have for getting readers. And I had planned a couple of like excerpts to try to like go on Hacker News or Lobsters to try to keep people interested in that way. And I like, you know, had shot all my shots, like, you know, some of them got popular and I got people to back the Kickstarter that way. But I was just like, okay, I'm definitely gonna miss it, which is a bummer. And then I think with like 2 or 3 days left, somebody resubmitted it to Hacker News and it made it to the front page and it was like number one. Like I had submitted the same thing to Hacker News, I think 2 or 3 times before, and it was just like no response. And then for some reason, this one in particular like got to the number one spot, and it was like I went from like 60% to 120% of the goal. And I was like, oh, okay. Like I actually am writing the book. So that was fun. But yeah, I don't know if I would do a book again, or I think I would maybe cut down the scope. I think the biggest mistake I did was just making the scope a little too large, because I was like, yeah, there's not that many things I want to talk about writing. It's probably going to be, you know, 6 months and, you know, like a 50-page book, 80-page book. And then like, as I got into it, I was just like, no, I like have opinions about this part and I have opinions about this thing. And like, I think people should write commit messages this way. And so Yeah, I think it could have been downscoped. And that's one of those things that it feels a little bit weird with the Kickstarter, where I announce a table of contents, and then if I'm later I don't want to include a chapter on emails or something, I don't want somebody to be like, well, hey, the whole reason I bought was I wanted to get better email. I think I overthink that though, because I feel like most people are I just want your thoughts on writing. It's not these particular chapters. And even if somebody was disappointed, I'm very liberal with refunds. I don't think anybody's asked for a refund yet. I've had people be like, I wasn't satisfied. And I'm like, okay, fine.
Yeah, I hadn't even remembered you did a Kickstarter. So that's just I've followed this process, but I've completely lost track of how this all started.
Yeah, it's a decade ago now.
So this process of you releasing chapters of books to the early readers who have subscribed is very similar to open source development process in a way.
Yeah.
So one of the things that, and it results in a lot of feedback, right, when you are building it up. So what was your experience of the feedback? Do you think that was very valuable for your writing? Or if you have done it all finished and put out there, and then maybe erratas the second edition and third edition would have been better?
There were a few key pieces of feedback. The one about content marketing versus blogging to find customers, there were a few pieces of feedback like that where it's radically changed how I presented something. Mm-hmm. Most of the feedback was a little bit more it was helpful, but I don't think it was it resulted in a totally different book. But I think the main thing that was helpful for me in releasing it a little bit of at a time is just having the motivation to keep going, having here's a new thing. It's here's a new feature. I'm working on this open source project, and now I released a new feature, and everybody that was kind of bored of the product, here's a new feature to play with. Here's a new chapter for you to read. Hearing people's reactions to the chapter made it a lot more motivating to keep going and keep writing. I know there are writers that are I'm just going to go into my cabin and work for 5 years and then come out with my masterpiece. And that's not me at all. I need the feedback and I need the feedback pretty frequently. I think 6 weeks without hearing anything from readers is pretty hard for me.
Yeah. So one of the philosophies I push in product development is release first. And the idea is to get something useful out in front of people that can actually use it or as early as possible.
Yeah, definitely.
And so it's kind of neat. You've just kind of approached this book project like you would product development.
Yeah.
Being a product developer yourself, I'm sure that had some impact on the way you did it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. So as I read through your latest draft, the book seems very concise. I like read through a chapter and it's like, whoa, this is like dense. This is good. And I'm through a chapter before I even know it. And I think, wow, that's really good. And
great.
So I wonder how much did you throw out, have you really aggressively trimmed down the site, trimmed stuff out and tried to shorten things, or is it just naturally flow that way?
No, I cut out a lot. Yeah,
okay.
I probably cut out. I don't know what it is for books. I feel like I cut out a little less than I do for blog posts. Generally, when I write a blog post, I cut out maybe 80%. I publish a little less than half of what I write. Less than half of, if you added up all the words that I did in earlier drafts, the end result is probably 40% or less of what I wrote.
That's pretty extreme.
Yeah. I mean, it's not as if I write a full thing and then I'm I need to chop down 60% of this. What often happens is I'll write something and then be this isn't quite how I want to present this. And so I'll rewrite, I'll write that paragraph or I'll write that section again. So it's not so much me I mean, some parts of it are me aggressively saying, okay, this is four paragraphs and it should be two, or this is four sentences and it could be one. A lot of me, what gets thrown out is okay, like this is like, yeah, this is not as concise, or is this is not as like eloquent as I want to put it, or this is just like doesn't feel cohesive. And so it's like me rewriting the same thing over and over. And like every time it gets like a little bit more, it feels a little bit more organic, or it feels a little bit quicker.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, a lot gets thrown out.
Yeah. That reminds me of a quote I heard. It's kind of attributed to Mark Twain, which a lot of things are that probably aren't, but he said, you know, I wrote you a letter. I'm sorry, I didn't have time to write a shorter one or something.
Oh,
like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the idea is it's easy to write a long piece, but it's really hard to write a short piece. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
It ties back into what we were saying about AI. Like AI loves to produce
a lot
of writing. You're paying by the token, so it works out for AI. It's not great writing usually.
So if I recall right, one of the things you emphasize in your book is to respect the reader's time.
Yeah.
Something like that. So I feel like your book does a good job of doing that as well. So.
Oh, that's good to hear.
Yeah.
So I'm curious, like, you know, you must have deleted aggressively. So were there cases where, you know, you're deleting something, you are like saying, no, I'm proud of this, I don't want to delete it, but then you still ended up deleting it?
Yeah, a lot. The thing I thought Cliff was going to say is there's a popular quote, kill your darlings. I know Stephen King popularized it. I don't know if he was the first to say it, but yeah, like sometimes there's writing that you really love and there's like something you feel proud of or has a lot of value, but it's just like not earning its keep on the page. Like everything you write, like it has value, but there's also a cost of the reader having to read it. Like it's real estate on the page. And so like you want everything to earn its keep. And so there's definitely a lot where I'm like, you know, there's like a joke or something that I like, or just some example or a quote or some part of my thinking that I think is like kind of interesting to share. And then I'm like, I read it again. And it's like, this is a part I kind of get bored reading, or like, this is a part I just feel like is too out of the scope of what the book is about. And I like make a deal with myself to make it easier to cut things. I'm like, okay, it's all in source history. Like I'm writing everything in a Git repo. Like if I really miss it tomorrow or next week, I can just go back to the previous version and pull it out. And it's so rare that like, it's always better without it. Like it's so rare that I'm like, no, I actually really did need that. Mm-hmm. But I'm currently like today thinking about a really big cut. There's a section in the book on design documents. And then I have a chapter on like how to review design documents. And I'm like, this is a lot. Like just like I felt really strongly about it at the time, because I'm like, it just feels like so part of writing a design document is like reviewing it with your team. Like it's so intertwined. And then I read it today and I'm like, that feels like not essential. Like it does not feel like it fits the other parts of the book. And so I'm leaning toward cutting out that whole chapter, or it's not a chapter, it's like a subsection, but I'm leaning toward cutting that all out and moving it to the website as like an extra bonus thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Cliff mentioned that, you know, you've basically written a lot of, it's a dense book, concise. So if like, you know, I were to apply only one chapter this year, you know, in my writing, which one moves the needle most?
Ooh, good question. I think it would be the meandering one. Like, I think that's the thing that would get you the most like value for the time you put in. Just like learning to really hone the introduction and convey to the reader like why they should continue, why it's going to be relevant and valuable to them. Mm-hmm. I'd say like the easiest thing to do, I think like this is, yeah, it was tough. Like these two things were neck and neck for chapter one. So the getting to the point is chapter one, and chapter two is only a page I mentioned, is like reading your writing aloud. And this is one of those things where like writing teachers had told me this for years. They were like, oh, you know, like before you submit this piece of writing, this essay, you should read it aloud. And I was like, why? Mm-hmm. Like I can read it in my head. Like I don't need to read it out loud. And then I finally tried it. Like, I'm such an idiot. I've spent like 30 years not following this advice, and it's so useful. And it really like catches things that don't sound natural, and like it's good at catching things. I've heard, I don't know if this is like actually scientifically true. I've heard that it like activates a different part of your brain, speaking aloud versus speaking in your head. And so it allows you to catch things where like, if I'm reading in my head and I have like the, like my brain just fixes it. But if I'm reading it aloud, I like say out loud the, and I'm like, oh, okay. Like I have a duplicate word there. And there's so many things like that where it's just like, it doesn't sound natural. Or like I start to read a sentence and like my brain says something that's not on the page, and whatever I said out loud just naturally is like 99% better than what's on the page. It was just like whatever my like tongue, you know, said on its own is like, that's the more natural end to that sentence. Like that's the way that sentence should have gone. So I think that's another, like, it's very easy to apply the technique. I think the biggest difficulty of applying that technique is just like, I guess like getting over the embarrassment. It like feels very stupid to like, especially if people can hear you. Like my wife sees me go into the basement and just like talk to myself for 20 minutes. But I think it is. It's just like so valuable to hear writing aloud and like hear those things that don't quite sound natural.
Yeah.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of the experience you have listening to a podcast or listening to a book versus reading it. And both experiences are valuable, but they're different experiences. So it's a good point. It definitely does activate different parts of the brain. And
yeah.
So any tips on self-publishing? I assume you're self-publishing this.
Yeah. I mean, for the time being, I have talked to publishers that are, it seems like they're pretty open to like doing a second edition, even if you've self-published the first. So like, to me, like self-publishing is, it's pretty much all upside that like you can do it yourself and you get, you know, close to 100% of sales revenue, and then you still have the option to go with a traditional publisher if you want. But yeah, like self-publishing, what are the things I've learned? Regional pricing was surprisingly valuable. I sell through Stripe, and Stripe makes it surprisingly hard to offer regional pricing. So, you know, like I was getting emails from people that are like in Peru, and they're saying like, hey, like your book is $30 in the US, but like in Peru, that's extremely expensive. That's like on par with like a night out for two for dinner. So that's like not really affordable to a lot of developers, even though developers make pretty good money relative to the average net. And I was like, oh yeah, like that totally makes sense. Like I can just offer different pricing. So I had to like do some like sort of ugly hacks to just make different like checkout links for different countries. And I've read other people's guides to do it, and it like relied on like React and stuff. And I'm like, I don't use React. I just want like a simple like static site thing. But yeah, I actually want to write a blog post about that, because it's sort of ugly under the covers, but the end user experience is not that hard. And also people are very concerned about like, well, I don't want somebody cheating. Like I don't want an American saying they live in India and like getting the book at a discount. I'm just like, I feel like the cost of policing that is like very high relative to the value. Like, I think if I was, you know, like if I was selling a New York Times bestseller and like general audiences were buying this book, like I would care. But it's like most people who buy the book are like, oh yeah, like I want to give money to Michael Lynch.
Yeah.
But other things I've learned about self-publishing. One of the really valuable things I learned, I actually met like one of my neighbors. I met at a block party, and she's a romance novelist. And the guy asked her what she does to try to find readers. And she told me that she started a newsletter where she reviews other romance novels, like other indie romance novels. And so people subscribe to her newsletter because they want to find out like other romance novels that are similar to hers. And so then she highlights these other indie romance novelists, and then like they're excited about it because they're like, oh cool, somebody is, you know, like reviewing my book. And like she generally picks books that she likes, and so she's saying positive things about it. And those people are like, hey, like, check out this newsletter that like I was featured in. And so that author's audience checks out her newsletter, and like it's sort of a win-win for all the authors involved. And so I started doing that. Like I interviewed other authors that I liked. I interviewed a blogger named Adam Gordon Bell, and he came and did he did like a live session for early access readers where like we just did like an open interview, and then I did a separate interview. And then at the end of the year, I kind of had this idea of like, oh, it would be kind of interesting to talk about which indie blogs were most popular on Hacker News. And so I like wrote, I originally was going to write like about the top 10, and then I sort of got bored. I was like, I don't really have interesting things to say about like all 10 of these people. And I'm like, I also don't know how much people are actually going to care. Like, do they actually care? Like, it's basically like a fluffier version of, I was already maintaining a list of like the top 100 authors on Hacker News. And so I just like, okay, like I'll just write about five, and like, I can write about five and feel like I'm putting in like a good effort without it feeling like lazy. And I'm just getting, I don't want it to just be like fluff. I want it to, say something interesting about each of these authors. And so I'm like, I can do that with five, and like, let's see what happens. And then it surprisingly became super popular. Like it went to number one on Hacker News. I think it was like maybe like 1,000 or 2,000 points, which is like pretty strong for Hacker News.
Yeah.
And I think that was like the second biggest month in terms of like website visitors, people that were coming just because they read that blog post. But yeah, I've done that. I wrote another one called The Software Essays That Shaped Me, about like some of the software blog posts and essays that have like really stuck in my head over the years, and like talked about what those authors did, what made the writing so effective. And I was surprised that like it's like a fun thing. It's like it benefits everybody. Like the other writers are happy that I'm talking about them, and like they send their readers back to me. And so it's kind of like a good, it's like the old fashioned web rings or something, where like people are kind of pointing people to other people, to other authors that are similar to them and that they like.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fascinating. I'm going through Perennial Seller now. It's a book about people who create enduring work that lasts for decades.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the patterns he notices is these people, they give away a lot of stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
So like these people that write books, they give away a large number of copies of them to people will, they don't worry about people stealing their books or whatever. It's more important to get it out there.
Yeah.
Than it is to protect everything to the nth degree. So
right. It's
an interesting concept.
Yeah.
So has it met, I guess you haven't released it yet, but has it met your expectations? Is it something you're satisfied with so far? Or?
It's been more successful than I expected. Like, I think, like I've talked to other indie authors, especially like first time authors, and I think there's like 600 customers so far, and I don't know what the total is, maybe like, I don't know, maybe $10,000, $12,000 in like total sales revenue, which is like more than most indie authors make, or like, especially people that go through a publisher, because you get an advance, and then unless your book is super popular, like you generally don't make much more than your advance. But I think honestly, the thing I'm like still trying to get, which like I haven't quite achieved yet, is like for the book to be sort of its own like sales machine or something. That sounds very crude. But the thing like I'd like to see happen is like for people. One of the books that inspired me to write this book is a book called Write Useful Books by Rob Fitzpatrick. And it's about his experience writing a book called The Mom Test, which became the super popular book, especially among like indie tech founders, as like, this is the book that you need to read to like understand how to talk to your customers early on. And it just became like people succeeded with it, and they're like, oh, you know, the way I succeeded was with this book, The Mom Test. And so what I'd like to do is like for my book to be so helpful to people that they're like, oh, like, you know, the reason I get to the front page of, you know, the subreddit or on Hacker News or whatever is because I read Refactoring English and like it was so helpful to me. And I'm not at that point yet. And like, I don't know if it's like a weakness in the book or because like I know a lot of the early access readers have been kind of waiting to read the full book. And sure. So that's been a thing that's been a little bit tricky about like releasing it in pieces, because some people are like, well, I don't want to read it in pieces. Like, I want to have the whole book. And I don't want to read your rough drafts either. So it's like there is like a small percentage of people that are like, you know, they want to see the early versions. But I think that the larger percentage of people are like, yeah, like I want to support you early, or I want to get a discount early, but like really I just want to read it once when it's finished and like in polished state. I'm hoping that like once it's finished I'll see more people like who have read it fully, but like the thing that I want to keep working on it until I've achieved is like I want to see people saying like, oh, you know, like the reason that I'm successful, like the way that I, you know, was influential at work was like from reading this book, and like it improved the way that I write design documents or emails, or like the way that I launched my business and was like writing a blog post according to the way that this book recommended I do it. So I haven't achieved that yet. I'm still chasing that part of it.
Yeah. So on the technical side, what tools do you, what markup language do you use? What tools do you use? How does this technically flow?
Yeah, so I use a tool called ASCII Doctor, which is pretty old. I think it's like a lot of Ruby code. Ruby is a language I don't know very well, and when I try to touch it, it scares me. But it's ASCII Doctor. I don't know if I would use ASCII Doctor again. It's the thing that's very nice about ASCII Doctor is that it can output to PDF, HTML, and EPUB. And the thing that's not so nice is that you're very limited in how much you can control the way that the book looks. And so, for example, like I have a lot of examples in the book, and I like originally was just writing it on the web and not really thinking about how it would look in a book or a PDF. And so on the web, I would just have a little box and I'd say like, this is the good example and this is the bad example. The good example would be like light green, and the bad example would be red, and just like very visually obvious. And then in the when I tried to do that in the book, in ASCII Doctor, it was very difficult to like get ASCII Doctor to, I'm like, okay, I just want to like figure out a way to like tell ASCII Doctor this box is red. And it's like, no, you can't do that. You have to like, for each line in the box, you have to like, I was expecting something kind of like HTML and CSS, but ASCII Doctor is not like that. So it's very hard. You're very limited in the control that you have. And so in some ways that's good. Like it forces you to be like, okay, like I have to write according to, like, I only have a few tools for like callouts and stuff like that. But the callouts that they give you are like, you have like three different kinds of callouts. There's like a generic box. Then there's like tip, caution, and warning or something. It's like tip, important, and caution or something, where it's like, that doesn't quite match up with how I would present it, but you're sort of locked into that. So I don't know. I've thought about like, if I were to do this again, I would maybe make my own, like use AI to like make my own thing that like compiles to, from like a markdown to like LaTeX or something, and then like LaTeX to PDF. But ASCII Doctor, I don't know. It got the job done. I thought it was okay. I would consider it again, but I definitely wouldn't like enthusiastically endorse it. I've heard good things about Typest. When I first started, I think Typest could not output to one of the formats that I wanted, but
sure,
it seems like they've been growing fast.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I've experienced too. Most of these tools do one format really well, but they struggle to do everything.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things, like PDF is more of a strict typesetting type output, and HTML and EPUB are more of a, like a web page, you know.
Yeah.
So it is hard to meet all those formats with one tool. So
I'm sort of blown away by, like, I talked to when I started the book, I talked to like No Starch and like the other kind of like indie technical books, and I was like, what, you know, like, just in case I come to you later, like, what are the formats that you accept? And a lot of them are like Word, Microsoft Word. I was like, what, really? Like, I've tried writing long things in Microsoft Word, and it's like, I haven't used Word in like 10 years, so maybe the experience has gotten better. But like, my experience is like, you somehow get into a weird state where like you deleted something and like now everything is bold for the next like 30 pages. And...
Yeah, or it's indented and you can't get it back.
Right, or, yeah.
Yeah. So my word replacement these days is Typist, and it can now consume Markdown. So you can write it and your content in Markdown separate chapters, and then Typist can kind of pull it together, theme it.
Nice.
Apply rules to it. You know, it's almost like CSS sort of.
Oh, cool.
But I did a data sheet recently in Typist, and it was amazing. So.
Oh, cool. Yeah, that's good to hear. Yeah. Yeah, the thing I find so difficult too about ASCII Doctor is that the syntax I find so unintuitive. Like Markdown, I don't know if it's just because I have so much more experience with it, but it's just like, I find Markdown syntax like very intuitive in ASCII Doctor. Like, to do curly quotes, it's like double quote and then like backtick. And like every time I have to remember to like put backticks in my, it looks so ugly. And yeah, almost every time I have to like do something, I have to look up the syntax for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So on the subject of tools, any other anything else you'd recommend generally as a tool for a developer?
I've sort of gone down the Nix rabbit hole, and like I use Nix for my publishing pipeline as well. So like I have if you haven't used Nix, it's like a very confusing system because it does so many things. It's a language, it's a build system, it's an operating system, and you can use different parts. Like, you can use the build system without using the operating system. But it's very good at reproducible builds. And so like I have basically a build system, so I can say like Nix build, and it builds every format of my book. But I can also say like Nix build HTML, and it just builds the HTML part. And I found that really convenient. And it also, I have checks within the Nix build as well. So like I have checks for like, I made the mistake with the curly quotes so much that I like just built in it like a pre-commit check for that. So like, I have a pre-commit check for things like, do I use the correct curly quotes? I actually wrote a custom tool for the error I mentioned of like the, where like you repeat the same word. So I wrote a tool in Zig called WordWord that looks for repeated words in Markdown. So I use that as well. But other tooling, I like Hugo. I use Hugo as the static site generator for the website. I know a lot of, like, Hugo seems to have like gone out of fashion and people complain about it, but like I still love Hugo. Hugo is like, it renders so fast, and the things people complain about like don't really bother me that much or impact me. So I use that for the website, and I found it it makes adapting the content to the website easy. Oh, and actually, speaking of that, one thing I use LLMs for that's very helpful is translating between formats. So like one of the things I've done a lot of is like I'll take a chapter of the book and I'll make a free excerpt on my website that's public, and then I'll like submit that to Hacker News or something, and that's been a really good way of finding users. But it's like very tedious to translate ASCII doc to Markdown, but LLMs do a really good job at that. And then also in the process of like making an excerpt, I'll like it's like, you know, I'm thinking about like, okay, what's somebody reading this standalone on the web thinking about, like, how do I make it like much more relevant to them? With like, if somebody's like on chapter 12 of a book, like you sort of, they're like more invested. They're not like, oh, two pages, like two paragraphs, and I'm going to give up. But if it's like, if it's a blog post you're submitting it to Hacker News, like, as I mentioned, like people have a billion other things they could read, and you like really have to fight to like show why it's valuable. And so I like end up trimming out a lot and like kind of condensing the beginning to make it much more clear. But then I do that and I'm like, oh man, like all these things that I did to like condense it, like that would benefit the book too. And now I want to translate it back to Ask a Doctor. And then, so like LLMs are pretty good at that. Although I actually found that like, that's a place where they will like make weird editorial decisions. Mm-hmm. Like I've been like, okay, like port these changes back to the Ask a Doctor. And then it's like, I'm like going through it. I'm like, wait a second. I knew I rewrote that part. And I'm like, what did you do? Like, why didn't you translate that part? Like, well, I didn't think that was relevant. What are you talking about? That's not your job. These LLMs are getting sneaky. You gotta stay on them.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting.
So I think any reading recommendations besides, you know, we talked about some of the books along this today, but any specifics that you have for our listeners or us?
Yeah, one of my favorite writing books is called the colloquial name for it is Strunk and White. What is even the, I forget the actual title. It's
yeah, it talks about grammar, right?
The Elements of Style.
The Elements of Style.
Yeah. I really like that, especially in like showing how you can make writing more concise. And in terms of just like good software writing, I think the greatest of all time for me is Joel Spolsky. Like I love Joel Spolsky's writing, and you know he stopped writing that actively probably about 20 years ago. But so much of what he wrote is still true. Like it still holds up. He had this blog post about like software estimation where he explains like how to estimate the duration of different software projects just using like Excel spreadsheets. And then he eventually like kind of took it back and was like, no, wait, I have a product that does this better. But mm-hmm. I always thought like the Excel version was like, and that's still what I do. Like I still think his method for software estimation is the best, but he's just like, he's such an amazing writer. And I feel like he's so good at like weaving in stories and like saying surprising things to keep the reader interested.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I definitely remember reading his stuff years ago. So
yeah,
that's good. Well, I think we're probably near the end of our discussion. So where can readers find this book, Michael, or where would you like to direct them?
Sure. The website for the book is refactoringenglish.com. And the book is called Refactoring English. And I have a blog about kind of the more behind the scenes stuff in my indie founder life. That's mtlynch.io. And I have monthly retrospectives. And then I also will write there about, you know, things I learned about software that are not related to writing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, those are the two main places to find my stuff.
Okay. Yeah. We'll put links in the show notes as well. And it's been great to catch up again, Michael, and we appreciate you coming on again.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thank you, Michael.
Appreciate all our listeners. And if you have feedback, please reach out. We're easy to find. And until next time, thank you.
Thank you.